Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. What is it like to be learning the fine arts of diplomacy during a war that holds little promise of a diplomatic solution? Elliot Cochran and Camden Hanley are completing their second year at the University of Kentucky's Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce, both with a concentration in security and intelligence. Elliot and Camden, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate being here.
And I wanted to talk with you two because of what's happening in Ukraine. You represent, to me, the future of foreign service, and I'm curious about how you view the situation. So first, how do each of you envision putting your education to work once you've graduated and enter the field, foreign service, or maybe the private sector? You want to begin, Elliot?
Sure. So I, as you said, intelligence and security concentration. So I will most likely take my focus to the intelligence community for the government or in a various private sector, such as Booz Allen, something like that.
And how about you, Cameron?
Yeah, so similarly, I'm also interested in the intel community, but I also would like to look possibly into the State Department and working as a foreign service officer. Living abroad and being able to help the U.S. further diplomatic efforts is something I'm pretty interested in myself.
Okay, and as I said, I wanted to talk to you too because of what's happening in Ukraine. What is it like to be majoring in your major, studying what you're studying, thinking about going into diplomacy and foreign service while all of this is happening between Ukraine and Russia?
So right now, you just don't get the kind of opportunity for that often, right? Like in that, obviously what's going on in Ukraine is terrible, but to be able to study what modern warfare looks like at a time when we're studying security, it's an opportunity that many students will never get. And it's really important that we try and capitalize on this and learn as much as we can.
How about you, Elliot?
Building off that, I would say it's a little overwhelming, right? So we are experiencing a major conflict in a time with social media and technology at its peak to where we can get on Twitter and surf for hours and hours on any specific point in this conflict and still be hours away from seeing a full picture. So I would say it's a little overwhelming, but a very unique position.
As you look at this conflict, what's your assessment of the way the West has responded to Ukraine's needs? We keep hearing President Zelensky calling day after day after day for more and more and more weaponry and support. And he's getting it, but there's always a need for more because this seems as though it's going to be a prolonged conflict. Would you like to take that one first, Elliot?
Yeah. So a lot of diplomacy, Cameron and I talked about this, and we've learned, is theater, right? So you are in a conflict, and your need for heavy weapons and weapons in general is very high. So Zelensky is working very hard to consistently show his need for military equipment. And I think the U.S. has done a fantastic job. NATO has come together and the U.S. has taken lead and provided some key equipment and intelligence that has been very helpful for Ukraine.
Camden?
Yeah, I'd agree with pretty much everything Elliot just said. Again, as we know right now, as Russia's pivoting towards the east and trying to assure that part of the conflict, this is a pivotal moment in this conflict, and being able to supply Ukraine with the proper weapons they can to repel this is going to have incredible implications for how this conflict possibly ends or continues to play out in months and hopefully not years to come.
There's been a lot of discussion at the UN about the war in Ukraine, but in the end, each of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council enjoys veto power, and Russia is one of those members and enjoys that power. The International Criminal Court is investigating war crimes Russia is accused of committing, but the U.S. is not a signatory to the ICC, neither is Russia. And Vladimir Putin keeps making nuclear threats. So in light of all this and all that has happened so far, the gruesome brutality of Russian forces targeting civilians, are we now beyond a diplomatic solution? What do you all think?
I think for diplomacy to work, you're going to have two willing parties, right? And right now, the Ukrainians' desired end states and the Russians' desired end states are so far apart, it's hard to imagine how a diplomatic solution can be reached, right? I think someone is going to have to, on either side, is going to have to sustain further military losses before they're willing to make the sacrifices to reach a ceasefire or an end of war agreement or something like that. So honestly, in my opinion, the short-term outlook is pretty grim.
Elliot, this must test the limits of the capabilities of diplomacy.
Yeah, so I would say it does. And just having nuclear power with the United States and Russia creates another rift in diplomacy where, you know, you can't push it too hard and bully Russia as the U.S. and NATO, even if we see their military falling short of what we assumed. You know, you can't be wrong with nuclear weapons. So with like Camden said, you're going to have to sustain heavy losses to bring Putin back to the talking table. And, you know, maybe he won't ever. And it's might come down to Russia's military completely falling apart.
Mm-hmm. I'm really curious about how this war is playing out among students. Just what are you hearing from fellow students?
We talk about it almost daily in class. And so, you know, there's a lot of chatter about it. I don't want to speak for every single student, but I think if you're at all interested in the state of the world, as many college students are, it's hard to ignore this kind of thing.
And I can speak on, you know, the undergrad portion because I am a teacher's assistant for a history class. As someone who has control over my specific sections, I am a fan of current events. I think it's important if you're studying history to learn about what's currently happening, what's currently being history. In addition, this specific history class is over World War I, World War II.
Mm.
So back in January, before this started, I was just pulling up current events, telling the students, you know, like, hey, look out. This Russia-Ukraine thing's, it's heating up. And then invasion started, and I had students staying after class, sitting, asking me questions. So I think that my interest has kind of spread through the classes that I teach and has helped them at least understand and talk to their friends. So hopefully, you know, it's just kind of spreading by word.
Each of you has now experienced a global pandemic, and that's been enormous. And it's now dovetailed into this war that threatens to escalate into possibly a global conflict. How have these events influenced your views of the world that you're preparing to enter?
I think that it's a very interesting time to be on the job market to work for foreign services in the United States. You have so many areas and near-peer threats that are occurring, and a shift in focus with the U.S. government on near-peer, peer actors instead of terrorism, which is just an overwhelming, you know, threats can come from anywhere. So it's really interesting. You know, there's a lot more focus on the actual things that we're seeing happen. So it's exciting.
For me personally, it's certainly reinforced the view that history is never over. It's a chaotic world we live in, and you always have to be ready for the unexpected, right? I mean, who could have predicted COVID-19? And who could have predicted that Russia would actually invade Ukraine? I mean, even when the buildup was happening, many experts were saying it doesn't make sense. Why would Russia do this? It's going to hurt them so much in the long term, and yet they still did it, right? So to be prepared for the chaotic world to flip things on its head is something that's very important and is reinforced.
Flexibility, huh?
Exactly.
I'm wondering what you would say to the graduating high school senior who's thinking about where do I go in the future? And they're interested in all of these events that are going on in the world. And they might may not even quite realize yet that their aspiration is going to take them in the direction that you've gone. What would you say to them if they decide, well, you know what, this foreign service thing sounds kind of interesting. What do I need to do to prepare for that?
Read all the time, Twitter. And Twitter is such an interesting thing because there's so many voices. Really scrutinizing your sources, you know, that I think is one of the most important things. And the more you read, the more you start to understand which sources are which. You know, it's at the beginning, it's very overwhelming to hear scrutinize your sources. What does that mean? we follow our professor, Dr. Farley, on Twitter. And from there, we have just built people to follow.
So you learn who to trust mm-hmm. and whose information to retweet that you can rely on and that you feel comfortable that the people that you're sending it to can rely on as well.
I would also emphasize reading, right? And not just reading current events, but reading history. That will give you a broad view of how things have happened before, how they may play out in the future. But I'd also like to add, be sure to learn a foreign language. That will give you such an edge in your competition in this field. And also, it will broaden your worldview. Learning a foreign language teaches you not only another language, but it teaches you about the culture of that place that you're learning that language of. And it just adds such a broad knowledge that you really can't get in any other way. And it'll give you access to primary source information that translations can't often provide.
All right, Elliot Cochran, Camden Hanley, now completing their second year as majors in security and intelligence at the University of Kentucky's Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce. Thank you both for coming in and joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up after the break, you're probably familiar with the first verse of the song My Old Kentucky Home, but how about the verses that follow?
When I heard all those lyrics and read them on a page as well, I saw pretty clearly that this was a song about slavery.
And our first 10-minute radio play about the last of the great black jockeys, an effort to bring diversity and inclusion to the equine industry, and details of the Paris Story Fest. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchtone Energy Cooperatives, reminding Kentuckians when it comes to electricity, safety is within your power. Be cautious around overhead or buried power lines, take care around downed power lines, and always teach children about electric safety.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Thoroughly researched, powerfully written, brutally honest, a page-turner. It's how Tom Eblin describes the work of his guest for this latest in our series on Kentucky authors.
Like many Kentuckians, Louisville historian Emily Bingham grew up singing My Old Kentucky Home every Derby Day. She loved the sentimental song written by America's first popular songwriter, Stephen Collins Foster. It was first published in 1853 and has been Kentucky's official state song since 1928. But like most Kentuckians, Bingham sang only the first verse and chorus. She didn't know the entire song or what its story was really about. When she learned more about My Old Kentucky Home, she understood why it has always been controversial, especially among African Americans. And she knew there was a good story there that needed to be told. Bingham spent many years putting together what is now her third book, My Old Kentucky Home, The Astonishing Life and Reckoning of an Iconic American Song. It was published May 3rd by Alfred A. Knopf. This book is thoroughly researched and powerfully written. It is also brutally honest. When I got my advance copy, I couldn't put it down. My Old Kentucky Home explores how this song was reflected a century and a half of race relations in America, and how hard it can be to give up myths and face the realities of our history. The writer Bobby Ann Mason summed it up well in her publisher's blurb. Mason wrote, "This book is not simply about lyrics of a song, but how that song has been used to tell a lie." Emily Bingham is here with us today to talk about her book. Emily, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Well, so what was it about My Old Kentucky Home that prompted you to write a whole book about it?
It really came to me as an adult and as a credentialed historian who you would think might have known more than I did. But growing up with the song, it was just so much a part of our fiber and part of our ritual that it's not something that I thought much about. So one Derby weekend, I was hosting a friend and for the first time kind of playing, you know, host, like to this out-of-town guest. And it occurred to me it would be good to explain some of our rituals and mint juleps and hats and the rest of it. And the song came to mind, and I just did the most bare kind of looking up of the song's original, you know, history and who wrote it and when. And lo and behold, I found a story that was just far more stunning and shocking to me than I could have expected.
Well, before we go any further, let's play a version of most of the original song's lyrics, its original lyrics. This was recorded in 1930 by the great African-American baritone Paul Robeson and includes the familiar first verse and the seldom-sung third verse that completes the story.
The sun shines bright in the old Kentucky home. 'Tis summer, the darkies are gay. The corn tops ripe and the meadows in the bloom, while the birds make music all the day. The young folks roll on the little cabin floor, all merry, all happy and bright. By and by, hard times comes a knocking at the door, then my old Kentucky home, good night. Weep no more, my lady. Oh, weep no more today. We will sing one song for the old Kentucky home. For the old Kentucky home. Head must bow and the back will have to bend wherever the darky may go. A few more days and the trouble all will end in the field where the sugar canes grow. A few more days for to drop the weary load, no matter, 'twill never be light. A few more days till we totter on the road, then my old Kentucky home, good night. Weep no more, my lady. Oh, weep no more today. We will sing one song for the old Kentucky home. For the old Kentucky home.
Emily, tell us the story that's being told here.
So when I heard all those lyrics and read them on a page as well, I saw pretty clearly that this was a song about slavery. And it wasn't only a song about slavery, it was a song about one of the darkest elements of that part of our history. It was about somebody being sold away from their family, away from everything they knew, to a certain death in the Deep South. The story just follows pretty much this very real part of history, which was many people enslaved in the Upper South were sold for high profits to work in the booming agricultural areas of the Lower South in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. And so this is a story like that. Hard times come, and this person is picked out and sent down river, and this is just, you know, what has to happen, kind of, is the way it's told. And there's a lot of singing about how good things were before that happened. And then the final verse, which your listeners will probably be able to tell, is a very final end, which is that the head must bow and the back will have to bend wherever this person with dark skin will go, and that their life will end in the field where the sugar canes grow. So I just saw this and it made me see how incredibly sad a song this is. And we're told to weep no more, and we're told to sing one more song. And I just couldn't really put all those things together with the way I had experienced the song before, in this, you know, crowd of, you know, lots of nostalgia and lots of excitement as well, and celebration, and how we ended up singing a song about slavery together just is really what led me on the journey.
Well, you know, so Stephen Foster wrote a lot for minstrel shows. And what did you find out about kind of his intentions when he wrote this song and how it was used?
Well, I wish I could speak to Stephen Foster, and there have been many historians and scholars and music musicians who share that sentiment, I know. He wrote a lot of songs. His most successful work were songs that were played on the blackface minstrel stage, and that is how they got their main popularity and spread from mouth to mouth and theater to theater and saloon to saloon, riverboat to riverboat, all across not only this nation, but the entire globe, actually. So he was having hits in the 1840s and 50s, unlike any other popular songwriter. But they were about Black people. And it was a white man from Pittsburgh, Stephen Foster himself, middle-class guy, trying to make a profession of this. And this turned out to be the most lucrative genre for him to pursue. And he liked to write other kinds of songs. And there are some of those that have come down to us, like Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair. Those are considered parlor songs or ballads. They are not about Black people particularly, as these definitely were, like My Old Kentucky Home and Oh Susanna, for instance. He just didn't find the success commercially with those works that he did with the minstrel songs that he published.
Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting things about the book is how you trace how the song just kind of evolved and changed and was kind of, you know, altered to suit whatever purpose, you know, some of them were kind of strange that people wanted to do. Tell us a little about how the song evolved.
Well, because it was such a popular success in its first, you know, decades of the 1850s and into the 1860s and on, it was picked up by popular singers all through, you know, really for a generation or two even after that, because it was just well known. So one of the things that's most striking is that Black performers in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s sang this song mainly for white audiences, as white singers had sung it pretending to be Black people for white audiences before the Civil War. But this was a period when Black performers were trying to get their footing in the world of entertainment. And what was chiefly allowed and expected of them were songs that their audiences associated with Blackness. And again, even though this really wasn't a song from a Black person's perspective, it purported to be, and they were expected to sing it. There's a great story about a group who was hired to play a party in New York around the turn of the century. And for once, they said, we just don't really know that song. And that's probably not true. And their employer was very disappointed and complained about it and probably never hired them again. But they were tired of singing a song that they felt did not express their experience or their traditions musically or historically.
Mm-hmm. Well, so it many white people, I think, really weren't aware that it was that controversial until the 60s or 70s when there was a lyric that was changed. But it had always been controversial among African-Americans and many others.
Yes. And I think that was the big revelation to me, that there had been person after person who had sort of sincerely tried to take this on and asked white organizations, institutions, school districts, for instance, to not teach My Old Kentucky Home and other foster material, songs like Dixie, for instance, to their children. And very, very rarely did those requests meet with a favorable reception. There was just a great deal of holding on to something that meant something very different to white listeners, something comforting, something familiar, something nostalgic. And embedded messages within My Old Kentucky Home that put many Black listeners was that it seemed to present a bucolic picture of slavery where people sang happily, and also that this was sort of the fate of Black people to fill these sorts of roles and celebrate those times, which had been anything but kind to them.
Joseph Seaman Cotter, who was a Black poet and educator from Louisville, who was inducted into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame in 2017, wrote new lyrics for My Old Kentucky Home 100 years ago. Tell us a little about that.
Yes, almost exactly a century ago, Kentucky as a state and its leaders made the decision to embrace this work by who was then being seen as the father of American music, from Pittsburgh, to embrace his music and his song and make it our brand as a state. And Cotter, interestingly, noticed all this going on. He noticed that they were going to buy a house in Bardstown and turn it into a place that tourists could visit and experience the 19th century and plantation life. And he had a personal connection to that place. His mother had worked for the family that lived there in the 1850s and had done the housework, had cooked the food, mended the clothes, milked the cows. And she was an indentured servant, and she was Black. But he went back there and visited the owner, who was on the point of selling the home to the state. And he left the house feeling uncomfortable. He said that if we have to continue singing it this way, we will have to stop singing it because it doesn't reflect what Black people are. And he proposed some actual slight changes that turned it just enough to be a celebration of potential for Black life and Black success rather than a reflection of a happy days on the plantation.
Mm-hmm. After all this research and writing, what kind of conclusions did you come up with? Should this still be Kentucky State Song? Should we still sing it? Does it need new words? Is it just kind of too damaged to do anything with? What do you think?
I was thinking about this even before I started the project. What do I do with the song before I even made it into a book? I was unclear how to behave at the times when the song came up. I talked to so many people about it as I did the work. I, obviously looked back in time at people who had raised questions about it as well. And the result is that the song sounds very different to me now than it did 20, 30 years ago before I had any of the knowledge I have. And I think, loving a song is something we're all made to do. I mean, this is, part of being human. I also truly believe that it's worth trying to know what we claim to love. And so I have asked myself, I've been listening to that song for so many years now. My request really is just that I hope that people of Kentucky and people all over this country who stand up and hear this song, which has beautiful strains to it. Of course, I mean, that's what we're responding to as well. And think about where it has been and what it has done and what it is coming from. And that is not just a Kentucky story. This is the kind of thing that we're trying to look at more closely all over this country about ways that we have depicted and perpetuated depictions of race that are just not what feels comfortable or makes for a comfortable or safe environment for all of our citizens. One poet I interviewed is a Kentucky poet who said that, when he hears it at University of Kentucky basketball games, he wonders what it would be like to have a state song that didn't depict him and people who looked like him as enslaved. And those kind of comments really sunk deep to me. Another comment from someone who lived through the civil rights movement and sat in and integrated public schools in Louisville, she turned to me, she just looked at me and said, "I don't understand why people like you like it so much. Why do you love it so much when, you know, it hurts us?"
Mm-hmm.
But this has been a long road for me, and I think it's worth listening and listening carefully and seeing how something can go from being one thing to being another, and how easily we forget, how easy it is for us not to think about things that are terribly difficult for other people. In many ways, I believe Stephen Foster, he was trying to appeal to a broad audience, as any artist or certainly musical artist tries to do. And in doing so, he whitewashed an institution that we're facing up to a lot more right now. And then when we changed the lyrics of the song to respond in part to the racial slur it contained, it sort of ghosted slavery altogether and ghosted race. So then many people really had no idea that it had this history. And I'm not here to say anybody is doing wrong by, you know, having enjoyed this song. I've lived with that so much myself. But in thinking about it, I really believe it deserves a second revisit.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. Once again, the book is My Old Kentucky Home, The Astonishing Life and Reckoning of an Iconic American Song by Emily Bingham. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom. It was great.
And this is Tom Evelyn for Eastern Standard.
The debut of our new series of 10-minute radio plays takes us to the track and to the story of the last of the great black jockeys, Jimmy Wingfield. To set the stage for you, here's Bill McCann, host of our series on theater production and performance in Kentucky, with Louisville playwright Larry Muhammad.
Larry Muhammad is an award-winning playwright of the full-length play Jockey Jim, about the jockey Jimmy Wingfield. He's also producing director of Kentucky Black Repertory Theater. Thank you for being here, Larry.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Just who was Jimmy Wingfield?
He was the last of the great black jockeys. Black jockeys won, I think, 11 of the first 15 Kentucky Derbies. And he was the last black jockey to win it. He won it twice in 1901, 1902.
Okay. And your play, Jockey Jim, from which today's monologue was taken, is a full-length play. The monologue runs less than 10 minutes. Can you set the scene, though, for our listeners? Let them know what to expect?
Yeah. He's in the jockey quarters. He's preparing for a race. This is actually the 1902 race. And he's doing calisthenics, and he's gaining inspiration from all the great black horsemen that went before him. And he's calling out their names, great black jockeys and great black trainers, and praying and asking God for the victory today.
Well, thank you. And now, a monologue from Jockey Jim by Dramatist Guild member playwright Larry Muhammad, featuring Emmanuel Thurman and directed by Patrick Mitchell.
Oliver Lewis, William Walker, Alonzo Clayton, James Perkins, Willie Sims, Austin Curtis, trainer of horses for the Founding Fathers, helped win freedom for the USA. Now, the improbable saga of Jimmy Wingfield, who galloped away from two straight Kentucky Derby victories to become a Phileas Fogg on horseback. He rode winners from Warsaw to Moscow to Paris, became a famous French trainer around the world in 80 years. Well, the Klan run me out of Kentucky. Commies run me out of Russia. Nazis run me out of France. Rode for princes and potentates. Last of the great black jockeys to win the Kentucky Derby. Won it twice, but won in 02. I helped start it all. Then got written out of history. We got left out. I tell you one thing for sure. People ain't seen the last of Jimmy Wingfield. rode those country horses bareback when I was 7 years old. And on Saturdays, we'd go to the track. Between the races, I'd play marbles with the stable hands. Then I'd sit up on that big white fence, watching the beautiful thoroughbreds come prancing by, watching the jockeys and wishing I was up there myself. Be like Simon, greatest rider in colonial days, known in Carolina, Tennessee, all through Mississippi, and down to Natchez Trace. Ed Brown, top-ranked rider during the Civil War, thoroughbred trainer with a real hot hand. Black jockeys, back in the day when money first got big in racing, white jockeys run them off the tracks. White boys ride up alongside a black jockey and just start whipping them, pretending like he's whipping his own horse. Jam a black boy so hard into the fence, it break the horse's ribs. Word was going around that white folks didn't want Negroes riding anymore. You have to know how to deal with the white man. Talk to him in a language he understands. Get what you want. Life gives you lemons, make lemonade. You got to always keep getting up. Fall down, get knocked down, but don't just lie down. Always keep getting up. You're looking at a winner of the Emperor's Purse, the Moscow Derby, a winner of the Grand Prix de Baden, the Kentucky Derby, 2 years straight, back to back. For Russia, where I got to be a millionaire. When the Bolshevik War broke out, I was eating caviar for breakfast, had a suite at the National Hotel, but not anymore. No more personal valet. Then, we drive 200 horses on their legs all the way from Odessa, Ukraine to Warsaw, Poland, and none of the villagers would feed us because they thought we were gypsies. And then we come upon this cow. But it was Lent, so nobody would eat her. We drove her along for 20, 30 miles, trying to get her to Easter. Finally, we swapped her for a pig and ate him Easter Sunday. But the horses that made it, that held up under all that hard travel, none of them raced again. All of them were worn out, spirits broke, weren't good for breeding, no good for nothing. But I never made anything like the money I made in Russia. Wearing fine clothes, sleeping in silk sheets, eating caviar for breakfast, and drinking champagne. And in Paris, when I was 48, after 2,600 wins, I rode my last. Went into training and bought this place called Maisons Lafitte. Yeah, we had some good times. Bojangles Robinson used to come by, and Josephine Baker. Then comes World War II. Germans invade and take over my stable, putting cavalry horses in stalls with thoroughbreds, whipping the ones that won't go in, whipped me when I tried to stop it. But what were the Nazis going to do? Kill me? My funeral would be spectacular, grander than Isaac Murphy had in Lexington, Kentucky. The thousand mourners. I will go in one of the grandest send-offs in Paris history, black or white. Men of affairs and celebrated horsemen would attend it. And the ceremony will be presided over by Roscoe Goose, who rode the biggest long shot victory in the history of the Kentucky Derby. Be like Cornelius, New York superstar in the 1800s, burning up the racetracks on the Eastern Seaboard. Jimmy Lee, come out of nowhere, Raceland, Louisiana, and in 1907 Churchill Downs, won 7 races in a single day. Be like Billy Walker, whole Kentucky legislator stopped business to see him ride. Be like Isaac Murphy, master of racetrack pacing, just lie down on a horse and bring it home. Being a championship jockey ain't near as much fun as it looks. Race day, you get up there and half the time you're scared to death. You win, and the public tends to forget who rode. People put their money down, and the minute it's over, in the final analysis, nobody gives a hoot who was up. Not really. Except the fans. And you couldn't do it without the racing fans. because horses win races, not jockeys. Just stay true to where you're coming from, and you always get to where you're going. You won't have any trouble, and you always make plenty of money. And that first Derby in 1901 wasn't nothing to it. I just got out front and stayed there. But today, need something special to win this race today. Oh, he's a rapid good horse. Broke so fast, I lost my right stirrup. But I fished for it and found it before we reached the stands. Then I get a hold of him, do the first two quarters in 25 apiece, and nobody can catch me. Two other horses try to come inside, but I duck straight for the rail. They try to come around, and I take them outside, both at once. Just a little, enough to get them into the sand. And when that other boy come up on my shoulder at the 16th pole, I foul him a little. I'm the favorite. They'll never disqualify me. Not in this race today. Father God, we come before you once more and again, your humble servant, Jimmy Wingfield, with bowed head and bended knee. Guide us in the saddle, O Heavenly Father, and give us this day the victory. Lord, we know that you can make a way out of no way, turn the bumpy track smooth and the crooked track straight. Help me, O merciful Savior, if he weakens around a turn. Strengthen him so that if we get bunched up, he drives fast out of the pocket, takes the lead, and if that boy comes up on our shoulder down the stretch, enable us to just draw away. Cradle us in the palm of your all-powerful hand, O Father, until we're safely across the finish line. These and other blessings we ask in thy Son Jesus' name, amen. It takes skill, judgment, and courage to beat a good field of horses, because you have to study each horse in the race and know how to get the best out of your own horse, how to hold him, save him from wobbling when his legs start to give down the stretch. If that boy comes up to me at the 16th pole, I foul him a little, just enough to get him into that deep sand. I'm the favorite. They'll never disqualify me. Not in this race today, which I am going to win.
Emmanuel Thurman as Jimmy Wingfield in a 10-minute radio snapshot from the full-length play Jockey Jim by Louisville playwright Larry Muhammad, directed by Patrick Mitchell. This is the first of a new series of 10-minute radio plays we'll produce and share with you from time to time. There is an effort underway to take meaningful strides toward increasing diversity and inclusion in thoroughbred racing. Out in front on this issue is the Legacy Equine Academy, founded in 2016 to encourage students in grades 6 through 12 to go to college and pursue degrees in equine, agriculture, natural resources, and environmental science. The Academy is the brainchild of Ronald Mack. Ron joins us to tell us about the inspiration behind the Legacy Equine Academy and what he hopes can be accomplished. Ron Mack, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And if you would, tell us a little bit about your background and why you've created this academy.
I grew up in the east end of Lexington, Tom, a project area. And on the street that we lived on back then, it was a huge oval. And when we went out back to play, whether it was football or baseball or whatever it was, we knew that there was an old track way back when, but we didn't know that we were living and playing on hallowed ground. And so my background is banking, and I lived in Atlanta for 10 years. And when I came back home, I decided to research those days when the track was there. And as it turns out, it was the Kentucky Association, which I like to call Kingland before Kingland. And so I began to research that time and came to understand the dominance and the prominence of the African-American horsemen as it related to the Kentucky Derby and the entire equine community.
And so you established the academy. Tell us how the academy will prepare a student for a degree in equine or agriculture, natural resources, environmental science, those kinds of things.
Absolutely. After conversations with folks in the industry is when we did establish the Legacy Equine Academy, which basically connects that history and that heritage that I spoke of regarding the Black Horseman to today's standards in the equine and agriculture industries. And so we have set out to give kids exposure and access on many different levels to the industry, whether it be horse farm tours or on-site visits. We also have internships and co-ops and things of that nature. So as our kids progress through that pipeline, that pathway that we provide, that they may have more interest in the industry. And our end game is to offer those kids who are keenly interested scholarships to go on to the next level to whatever university they decide to approach.
All right. Well, how many students can the Academy accommodate? How many are involved now?
Well, we work with both middle school and high school in Fayette County Schools, and we are developing a partnership with Scott County Schools, and we also have relationships with schools in the Louisville School District. And so each chapter, we average around 25 kids with each chapter, and our chapter, we call our chapters as each individual schools. And so we have the bandwidth to accommodate 8 middle schools in Lexington and 3 of the high schools we have relationships with, and also work with schools in Louisville as well. And so as we continue to grow our brand, we're able to reach more kids as we develop our resources and our staffing.
I think I understand that you also recently partnered with Spy Coast Farm, the performance horse operation out near the Kentucky Horse Park. Is that true? And tell us about that arrangement.
Absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that. We have developed a relationship with Lisa Lori and Spy Coast Farm, and that relationship helps us, again, to give educational opportunities in the equestrian industries as it relates to kids moving in that direction. And so with their classrooms and resources and access and opportunities to get educated really promotes our program to an even higher level in the way of educating our young people.
Well, how do you hope that the efforts that you're making through the Academy will influence the future of equine in general and racing in particular?
And I'm glad you asked that question. You mentioned it in your intro, is that we want to assist in growing the equine industry to a broader, new audience of folks who may not otherwise have been interested. And so with that, we have developed the Lex Equine Academy to produce young, growing talent into the industry. And we also endeavor to bring in, again, a new audience of folks to enjoy the industry at large. One of our initiatives is we've established the Legacy Society, which will, in partnership with Keeneland and Churchill Downs and the Kentucky Horse Park and, of course, Spy Coast, allow us to give the opportunity to give access and exposure to those related industries to people who are interested but have just not felt comfortable in that particular industry, in the way of employment, in the way of just enjoying it as a lifestyle. And so we set out to really and truly trailblaze the community to enjoy an industry and an area that we call the horse capital of the world.
All right. That's Ron Mack, founder of the Legacy Equine Academy in Lexington. Thank you so much, Ron.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate you, the visit.
Tell me a tale that always was. Sing me a song that I'll always hear. Tell me a story that I can read. Tell me a story that I believe.
Mary Lovell is back with us with details of the annual Paris Story Fest coming up May 13th through the 15th. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And also with us is one of the artists performing at this year's fest, Woodsongs creator and host Michael Jonathan. Hi, Michael.
Tom, thank you for having me on.
So, Mary, talk to us about the power of storytelling, which is what this festival is all about.
You know what? A lot of people don't realize what storytelling is. They think it's reading from a book. Even one of our newspaper reporters thought that. And I said, no, it's actually performers who get up and tell a story. It's very much like drama, only they don't move around. They just stand in one spot and tell a story all by themselves. So it's an art form. It really is. And I would like to promote it as much as I can.
We talk a lot in public radio about theater of the mind, and this is kind of a cousin to that, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's called the Paris Story Fest, but I understand that Carlisle is also involved. How so?
Yes, we have two really strong supporters down in Nicholls County, and because they raise enough money for us, we go to their schools for free and one of their churches on Sunday. The Metcalfs are the ones who are our supporters down there.
Well, that's really great of them. So briefly, tell us about this year's lineup. Who do you have?
This year we have Adam Booth, who is returning, and Kim Weitkamp are both returning this year. And so is Michael. So he came our very first year and volunteered, and I was so proud of him, and I loved him. I wish we could have had him every year. But we found out he was living in Bourbon County, and so we nabbed him as quickly as we could. And we also have Reggie Carpenter and Olivia Sexton, who is from Kentucky. And this is the first year we are having a youth teller, Sky Bird, who is also from Eastern Kentucky.
Let's bring in Michael Jonathan. As mentioned, he's creator and host of the WoodSongs Old Time Radio Hour, airing at 8 p.m. every Saturday here on WEKU. Michael, tell us what you're going to be doing at Storyfest.
Well, you know, they invited me to host. They have a morning jam on Saturday morning.
And can anybody join in?
Absolutely. Bring your guitars and your fiddles and your banjos and your harmonicas, and we're just going to sit in a big circle for an hour and enjoy each other's company and song. But mostly being able to tell stories, storytelling was the journalism of rural America for a long time. And this is a beautiful, beautiful art form.
Back to you, Mary. Do we need to do anything in advance or just show up? And where will this be happening in Paris?
Well, we have different venues, from the Hopewell Museum to the library to the Wallace Garden Club. And this is the first year we're going over to Chief Reed Park. And I hope we get a good audience over there. We've never before tried this, so I hope it works. They do need to sign up for the dinner, which is Saturday evening, and it's $35. And this year, we're having a horse tour of the Nally Stud Farm. And it starts with the breakfast Saturday morning at 9 o'clock at Trackside Restaurant. And that's free except for the cost of a breakfast.
All right, that's Mary Lovell and Michael Jonathan on this year's Paris Story Fest. It's happening May 13th through the 15th in Paris and also in Carlisle, Kentucky. Mary, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
And good to hear from you, Michael.
Tom, it's always great to talk to you.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor. Ella Fitzgerald Dean, studio dog. My Old Kentucky Home, performed by Paul Robeson. Tell Me a Tale by Michael Kaiwanuka. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org, and on the WEKU mobile app, NPR One, and the Google News app. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.